where QR codes kill kittens and customer service is an oxymoron, one podcast has set out to make things right. This is the Unpodcast with your hosts, Scott Stratton and Allison Kramer.
Well, a happy March to you, or whenever you're listening to this. Maybe you're listening in the archives. Maybe this is 2023.
What did you guys get me for my birthday?
That's
a really important question.
Fun fact, Allison's birthday's coming up.
Yeah, my birthday's like next week.
Well, but when they're listening to it, it's probably last week or the week before.
Yeah. And on the last episode...
Did you like your present?
I'm sure I did. On the last episode, we talked about my fancy Valentine's surprise. Mm-hmm. So you can't just ride that through my birthday, you know. You gotta like...
Fun fact, not only did Scott fly out on Valentine's Day, Scott is also on the road for Allison's birthday.
That's okay.
Oh yeah, it happens. Right, people. This is how this works. Enjoy this. The show is brought to you by Dallas, our dog, walking around in the background. Just in case you're missing some paw print sounds, we got them for you. Around now, we'll be heading out on our family Disney cruise,
which we cannot wait for. I think this is the most excited I've ever been to go on a cruise.
It's our fifth or sixth one, depending on the stats you look at.
And it's not only because the cold around here just gets passed between people all winter long.
Yeah. It's one of those examples of, we call impenetrable brands, where kind of competition's irrelevant, where, you know, we've been told, why don't you try a different cruise line since it's the only one we've ever used, and there's no reason to. Except for the fact that Ritz-Carlton announced that they're coming up with a cruise ship in the near future.
But we're not taking the kids on the Ritz-Carlton cruise.
No.
That's not happening.
No. But it's like a smaller ship, like 280 people total, guests-wise, in the Mediterranean and all suites and everything.
That's gonna
else.
That's going to be maybe a grown-up trip, I think.
Yeah, and we'll be the youngest people on the ship by 20 years.
Well, we can keep telling ourselves that.
But. Yeah, I will. And I am.
Okay.
On the show today, same as always. That's it. On with the show.
What you got?
I saw something on Recode.net that I found interesting. It says nearly half of American online shoppers pay for streaming media services. And another thing about box subscriptions. I'll just read it. It's very quick part of it, but I want to discuss it. It says some 46% of online shoppers in the U.S. pay a monthly subscription for online streaming media like Spotify or Hulu. According to a new survey by consulting firm McKinsey, 15% had subscribed to at least one e-commerce delivery service like Dollar Shave Club, Blue Apron, or Stitch Fix in the past year. Most e-commerce box subscribers have streaming media subscriptions as well. The survey tried to take a deeper look into online subscription demographics and behaviors. Some of the findings from the report says women are more likely to subscribe to an e-commerce than men, but men are more likely to have three or more such subscriptions. Women also do not like crunchy chips. e-commerce subscribers tend to be young, wealthy city dwellers. The median e-commerce box subscriber has two such subscriptions, while 35% have three or more. Word-of-mouth recommendations are a key reason consumers sign up for them. Meal kit delivery services have higher cancellation rates in the first 6 months than other e-commerce subscriptions. McKinsey conducted its online survey from November 8th to 12th, 2017, receiving over 5,000 responses from 5,000 participants. Of those, 80% were online shoppers, defined as people who spent at least $25 online in the past month.
I was trying to think of what subscription services we have. So we have like Netflix, I assume is included in that, and Spotify.
Yep.
And we have other TV ones too, right? Crave.
Crave was one of them.
That's in Canada though. Yeah. Not everyone will know of that.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a lot of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then, but we don't really have the, like, you know, tie of the month club kind of subscription.
Right.
Netflix.
Yeah.
We have done we did for a while like an organic box.
Yep. A local to the farm one.
Which was great. Eventually it was just challenging because we travel so much and I hate throwing out food. So it just became challenging with that. But we have too many people really to do any of the meal ones. Like I've looked at a few of the different meal services and they're generally aimed at either, you know, couples or maybe one or two children, and we just have way too many children for that. I'd need like three of the same food subscription to feed everybody that's here. So.
We've talked in past shows about the wardrobe ones. They'll send a box of clothes, you try them on, and you send them back. And I'm just thinking, what would you subscribe to on a monthly, not a subscription, but a box service?
You're asking me because you've already bought me my birthday present. This is after that. No.
It's a Jelly of the Month Club.
You know what was interesting about it, though, is that it's so not new.
Right. Like, Jelly of the Month Club.
I mean, it's such an old idea. And like, why can't I remember the name of the cassette tapes?
Columbia House.
Yeah, Columbia House. Yeah. So it was like I was a child and I remember that. So what I love about this is I think people just love getting mail. And I think people love the idea of something new coming and surprising them. And I like the idea of using it for all of this stuff. But I don't think it's new, this idea that people like to subscribe to this.
I had a wine club membership for a year because I got suckered in at a winery.
It's funny because you don't drink
wine. No, not at all. And so, but I just used it for gifts.
Yeah.
It's a great way to fill up the gift cabinet and then be able to give them to housewarming stuff. And I made baskets for Stag and Stag and Doe's with them and stuff. But it was, so it's not a new concept. The difference is it's new when it comes to at the size of the market now, where it used to be just the Jelly of the Month Club or the Wine Club. I've seen the Beer Club as well. To this
tons
point
of kid
where
ones, makeup ones.
Now it comes to like staples of like of your day, like BarkBox.
Well, and the shaving one, Dollar Shave Club, which we love, and we've had great experiences with them.
They send us free stuff, so that we love them.
We don't shave enough. We're not the customers.
I've had one razor since 98.
Yeah. We're not the right customers. Maybe when the boys get a little older, then
But what, Wayne, do you get anything? Monthly subscription? Like, not like Spotify, but like a delivery type. Something comes.
No, I don't have any of those.
No.
Like, I used to have magazines and stuff.
But. Yeah,
magazines. Well, there you go. Magazine for sure. But so I signed Aiden up. So Aiden is the oldest of our five and who's at Fanshawe College for Music Industry Arts right now. He wants to be a producer. And I signed him up for Christmas. I got him a 3-month subscription to an album of the month club. And what happens is you get an album from an unknown but a curated
like
band.
Like an actual record.
You fill in your preferences. They send you the album. They send you a booklet of all the story of the band and the story behind the songs and a cocktail recipe that suits the music style. And he loves it. Yeah. Every month it comes in, he's like, this is so cool because it's a curated collection of things in it. Loves it. And then it's like, so I could gift it to him, which was great. And then he can choose whether or not he wants to just keeps going on it as well. So it's like a surprise every month it comes. I think a lot of times too, those are more cool as gifts if you know the person well enough. You know, nothing worse than getting something every month you don't want.
It does make a cool gift.
Yeah, it was very cool.
I think if I was going to do one again, it would be another food one.
Yeah.
Because I did really like that. Like it was fresh, organic, local produce and something came and it just became too much. We just had too many people and it became... too much to keep up with.
But I think that's why one of the reasons why the food delivery, meal delivery ones have higher cancellation rates because you see the waste of the food because you have to throw it out. Like if you get a book of the month club or something else, it just sits there and it doesn't exactly get thrown out necessarily. So it's an interesting concept and it's guaranteed revenue for a company, right? You build an X number of subscribers, it makes sense. Well, Amazon Prime is a subscription based type of things and it shows what it can do for a company, but I'm trying to think of what else.
What would
be out there that you would get, or I would get, or that would be interesting to see you sign up for?
I have a problem with like. I think I prefer one-off gifts, and this is probably a personality thing. Right. That I can't imagine what it would be that I would want. It's also interesting from the other side of things is the purchasing side. Like I remember when I had my company before, and I would go to like big baby product shows, there would be buyers. And one the two things that surprised me the most were the buyers from points clubs, like Aeroplan or like, I don't know what it is in the States, but like the big points.
Air miles or something.
Yeah, air miles. Like for that they'd have all these products and then you could trade your air miles. So there were buyers for air miles shopping for products to then put in the rewards, which I hadn't thought about before.
Right.
And then the other one were subscription services. So if you're going to be the, let's say, candy and flour, whatever, then you're going to need to source that candy. Or if you're a baby one, you need to source the blankets and the rattles. And I have known companies along my path, my journey, who ended up going that kind of route, like being the rattle that's in the this and that subscription service. So I think it's interesting on the other side too for entrepreneurs with products to make sure that they think about that when they're looking for customers. That might be a really good way to go because again, you're down that chain of a guaranteed sort of customer every so often. And I think it's a neat, I think it's neat.
Yeah,
it's a great gift. That's how I always think about it.
I certainly like the disruption of it too and where people can listen right now can think of where in their industry could it possibly happen because a lot of industries wouldn't think. I always loved the idea and I thought my sister would get into this. We had bantered it around a bit a few years ago, but I thought of, you know, a clothing for babies kind of subscription type of thing that grows with the kid.
Yeah.
You know, right? The older you get, they start moving into different styles or different sizes of clothes and stuff like that. So it's a fascinating side of the world. And giant, it's a huge, obviously a huge money-making type of thing too. But I do love our subscription. We're almost fully cable cut in this household from everything we use. And I don't think I could live without them. They're wonderful.
Aww. Did you want me to ask you what subscription you wanted? Because you asked me twice and I realized I didn't return the question.
No, I wasn't one of those. It wasn't one of those asking you, so you asked me. I don't know what I would do.
You don't know what you would do?
No. I'm just, I t-shirts. We used to.
But then you have so many t-shirts.
But that was it with Sevenly. Yeah. I was buying every week from them. If they had it, that will auto send you.
You know that wasn't a subscription. Like you just had a problem.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I don't think I need one. I don't. It's a comic book statue of the month I would take, maybe, right? But the Columbia House, that brings out some great memories for everybody, right? How many versions of Columbia House did you use there, Wayne, the millennial?
BMG,
right? Columbia did it? House. CDs, right? Yeah. I did.
I started with tapes, though.
Yeah, I did cassettes and CDs. I didn't think they did albums anyways. But I also did VHS. I did video cassettes, too. So I did DVDs, VHS, CD, and tapes.
I never did that.
No?
No, I've never had one of those.
Never did any of them?
No, never.
The one penny for 11 albums, and that shipment came in, you're like, oh, mama.
And then change your address.
And this is the problem with subscription services.
Right? And then they'd send you it was the negative billing, right? They'd send you the next month unless you had said don't send it, and then you were billed $29.99 for Europe, the final countdown. And 5 remixes on the tape. Still good album overall, but I did enjoy. I still remember that because back then it was in a magazine insert, and then when I did it, you'd tear out the little stamps, lick them, and stick them to the postcard that would say what you'd get. There is a documentary, like an underground documentary on the behind the scenes of Columbia House. I have it on my desktop,
oh, really?
On my laptop, and I can't remember the name of it, and I will look it up. But it was I'm just getting ready to watch it. It's supposed to be epic. And it was filmed in the 80s, right? But it was something about all the behind the scenes, how bananas it was, and how fascinating to me of how they never got, did you know this, Wayne? They never got permission to make these tapes.
Are you serious?
They never got permission. So it's called The Target Shoots First. It's from 1999, but the video is from, I think, from the 80s. And it's... Yeah, it's well received, and so this is the story that I heard of with Columbia House. And for those that don't know, being a place you get 10 tapes, 10 CDs for a penny, and then you have to buy 3 or 4 or 5 for the next year at full price to make it worth it. Columbia House never got permission from the labels or the publishing
to do what?
To sell these
the music?
Albums.
So how did they get them?
They just said, well, first off, they said, well, we'll just do it so much and so often. Because if you looked at the tapes, it said produced by Columbia House, manufactured by Columbia House. And so they sent royalty checks to the labels. And as soon as they cashed the first one,
that was a
contractual agreement that you accepted the payment. They didn't work out any rights whatsoever with these labels. And the labels just loved the free money. People said, wouldn't you object to be giving out 12 of your albums for a penny? They're like... They just, every month we'd send them, they get to a point, millions of dollars a month in checks. What are the label going to say? What are they going to sue us for? Millions of dollars we're giving them? So it was, so they produced their own tapes, their own CDs and everything else. And it's because you saw it, because we used to try to sell them back to the used record store in town. And the guy's like, I'm not, it says Columbia House on it.
Because I didn't have the service. So if you ordered a certain CD, when it came to you, it was like someone had made it.
No. So it was exactly the same, except printed on it. It was Toe Pro. Like, it wasn't like a bootleg. It was fully, but under the bottom, it said manufactured by Columbia House.
The same cover and inset as a regular CD?
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah, right? It blew my mind when I heard that first. Now, maybe it's not even true, but I'm going to watch that documentary and we'll see. But it's, fascinating world and business model. And they rolled in it. They just rolled in the money for it, too. It was and everything by check and everything by... And they had to do buy for a penny... Or a dollar it was, or whatever the amount was to make it a legal purchase type of thing. So, yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's going back old days. So, it's from thefashionlaw.com, a site that's becoming more and more my favorite site out there. This is how Abercrombie ended up being sued by 250,000 employees. It says, quote, "A lot of people don't belong in our clothes," Mike Jeffries told Salon in 2006, explaining the culture of the brand he was tasked with overseeing at the time. "That's why we hire good-looking people in our stores. Good-looking people attract other good-looking people, and we want to market to cool, good-looking people. We don't market to anyone other than that." That brand was Abercrombie & Fitch, Of course, the traditional mall retailer known for its clean and classic apparel, its ad campaigns, complete with semi-nude models, and its explicitly exclusionary attitude. This is something Jeffries, who had been hired in 1992 to revamp the brand following its bankruptcy and subsequent acquisition by Limited Brands in 88, would freely admit. Are we exclusionary? He asked himself aloud. Absolutely. The rationale behind Jeffries' flippancy is, I don't want our core customers to see people who aren't as hot as them wearing our clothing. God. Jeffries himself came of age in Los Angeles, hence his beach blonde hair and penchant for the word dude. I already love him. Ugh. Before studying at the London School of Economics and Columbia Business School, from which he would earn his MBA. He joined Abercrombie from Paul Harris, a Midwestern women's chain, at age 48. Despite his wildly controversial public dialogue about the Abercrombie's revamp, within just a few years as CEO, he had succeeded in crafting the retailers into one of the hottest brands of the 90s. In its heyday, Abercrombie boasted a network of 700 dimly lit and thoroughly fragrant stores, 22,000 strikingly attractive employees, and nearly $2 billion in annual sales. The entranceways of the individual stores were flanked with shirtless teenage boys, the walls covered with Bruce Weber-lensed ad campaign imagery of more toned and tan teens. The music was loud, and the offerings, A&F logo tees, $90 distressed jeans, and ripped denim skirts, which went up to size large, no XL for girls, and certainly no XXL, irresistible to teens that wanted to embody the lifestyle it was selling and could afford to do so. By the early mid-2000s, Jeffrey had irrefutably taken the dusty 100-year-old casual wear brand and turned it into one of the most relevant destinations for the all-American collegiate types. In large part, Jeffries, who was bringing in $71.8 million in compensation as of 2007, succeeded thanks to the wildly specific branding he put in place. Abercrombie was an apparel business with his relatively pricey miniskirts and house-branded polos, but let us be clear, under the direction of Jeffries, the retailer was selling sex first and foremost, and was only selling it to good-looking, cool kids. This is where the retailer's now notorious look policy came in handy. Specific guidelines on everything from the color and length of employees' hair to the specifics of girls' makeup, quote, must be worn to enhance natural features and create a fresh, natural appearance, to the length of fingernails helped to ensure that, as Forbes put it, the sales clerks all looked like your biggest high school crushes. Treating hiring like model castings also worked to further this narrative. Store managers would often approach attractive white customers who had the look and urge them to apply for sales jobs, according to Think Progress. It was imperative for Jeffries, who according to Salon made every decision from the hiring of the models to the placement of every item of clothing at every store, that everyone from the greeters in the store's entranceways to the individuals behind cash registers looked the part. The looking the part requirement was observed so strictly that according to a lawsuit filed in 2003, any Asian American, African American, and Latino individuals who were hired by Abercrombie were relegated to stock rooms where those staffers could not be seen by customers. The retailer settled the suit a year later, agreeing to pay $40 million to put an end to the litigation. That lawsuit was followed up by another headline-making case just over 5 years later when the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission filed suit against Abercrombie after the retailer refused to hire a young Muslim woman, arguing that because she wore a hijab, according to her religious views, she did not comply with the company's strict dress code. Despite a ruling from the Supreme Court in 2015 that Abercrombie's look policy ran afoul of federal law, the company was undeterred. Any doubts as to whether Abercrombie's look policy, which was made clear via internal company documents and posters such as hairstyle sketchbooks, was still being enforced to any meaningful extent after America's highest court called foul were clarified when another lawsuit was filed against the retailer. Whew. And it was 2015, 1 year after Jeffries retired from CEO position in light of 11 straight quarters of same-store sales declines, and after he was ousted as chairman of Abercrombie's board of directors due to investor pressure, when they faced another damning lawsuit. Former employees Alexander Brown and Eric Silva filed a suit against the retailer in federal court in California, alleging Abercrombie management required its hourly workers purchase the brand's clothing to wear on the job. In doing so, Abercrombie was, according to the lawsuit, running afoul of various state labor codes. As Brown and Silva set forth in the suit, Abercrombie policy forced employees to buy new Abercrombie clothes each time a new sales guide came out. The suit further alleged that the retailer failed to reimburse employees despite obligating them to wear specific uniforms. Which is against the law in many, many states. In order to avoid trial, Abercrombie payment of $25 million, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
It's weird because so my earliest memory of Abercrombie was going to the States with my dad, and I probably was 9 or 10. And there was an Abercrombie & Fitch store, and we went in, and it was totally different than the ones you see now. It was, like, really old-fashioned. It looked more like a really old Polo Ralph Lauren store. It was very expensive, very old-fashioned, sort of like dark wood. And I got a to-the-floor, you want to talk about mini skirts and ripped jeans, to-the-floor green corduroy skirt, which I loved, which was definitely not hip or cool, and you couldn't have told what size I was underneath it. But I loved the store because my initials were AF. And they had all the Abercrombie stuff has AF on it. So I had like a hat and a t-shirt. And the brand was like for older, wealthy. Like it wasn't for young kids at all. So when I started seeing them like as an adult, I always like knew, I knew they hadn't gone into business. But when I started seeing it as an adult, I thought it was so weird because it's not really the same store that it was when we were kids. And, you know, I've heard his comments before. This is probably one of those like bad stories for me, but I get the boys' clothes at Abercrombie. I get the Tessa clothes at Abercrombie because they're very tall and skinny, and it's hard to find jeans that fit them. Like, it's hard to find that size. And Abercrombie is one of the few stores that will sell, you know, a really tiny waist, really long-legged jean. Obviously not for a good reason, but I still need to keep the clothes kids wearing clothes. So, you know, I do buy clothes there.
Should a company be able to hire good-looking people only?
I don't remember being your looks being covered under the, you know, but
it's not covered under human rights.
I think it's a bad choice in that what I think they're not seeing is that the racism is terrible and not the right choice. I think they're absolutely wrong. They hire good looking people to be in their ads. Why can't they hire good looking people to be in their stores? But that's very different than saying the only people that are good looking are such people. That's where the racism comes into play.
Right.
There's no reason why a woman wearing a Muslim head covering can't be beautiful. Like that is totally different than saying, well, we just want good looking people in our store. So that crosses the line for me. I think they have the right to, and it's like having a uniform, right? If you decide your store is going to have a uniform, your restaurant is going to have a uniform, that's fine. And in some ways, I understand wanting everyone to look a certain way, and they're easy to pick out. And I get wanting to have almost like live models walking around your store wearing the new collection. Totally get that, because the kids are going to see that person wearing it and they're going to want it.
Mm-hmm.
Get that. But to make them pay for the clothes is ridiculous and obviously illegal. So it's like there's like some room where it's okay, and then he's crossed like a million lines where it's not okay.
Yeah. And so I used to always ask students that when I taught them in HR about, you know, can I fire you because, or can I not hire you because I think you're ugly? And they're all like, no. I'm like, yep, you can.
It's not covered.
As long as it's not because I think you're ugly because you're white.
Yeah.
Or you're black. Or anything under the human rights code. So that's how I explain to them indirect discrimination. Where you're saying it's this, but it's because it's related to that.
I think too, a lot of other stores do it too, and he's just been really, really blatant about it.
Good looking sells.
And even wanting them to have their hair a certain way, other than the hair covering, which obviously that's over the line. Mm-hmm. But saying that if you're not wearing a head covering for religious reasons, that if your hair is going to be down, it should be pulled back, it should be neat. Or down, or whatever your thing is, I get that. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm sure half the people that work at, like, Lens Crafters don't need glasses, and they're just wearing glasses. Like, if somebody sells me something and they're not using it, I'm always a little bit like, what is happening here? So, do you know what I mean? Like, I'm
a vegetarian working at a butcher.
You want to buy from, like,
that was extreme. That was extreme.
They're really models walking around the store, and they've taken it to this nth degree and then stepped well over the line, but I do think that they're, like, at the core of it, that idea, he's just been so vocal about it, which he's a jerk, obviously. I mean, I think that's clear. But I do think that, obviously, I've crossed the line.
Polarization sells, though, right? That's how we hire for the Unpodcast, based on looks. That's why Wayne's so handsome. That's why he's still back there. That's how we do these things. Looks first, kids. That's how it happens.
Skills second.
Bingo. Skills second, looks first. Unpodcast.
And they can carry any sizes they want. We've had this conversation before, too. I think it was like Brandy Melville or something, this store that we have only a couple of them in Canada, but I think they're big in the States, and they only carry up to a certain size. And even that size, like, first of all, not all sizes are the same. I've got news for you. Like, one size small at one store is not the same as another size small at another store. And Like, that's up to them. You don't have to shop there. I mean, I understand why people are offended, but I also don't think that that's an illegal. There is no law that says if you sell clothes, you need to sell every single size.
Right. 100%. Same as a plus size store. You don't have to sell smaller sizes.
No.
Same idea.
I got it a lot when I was selling bras. I got a lot of people upset because I didn't sell a certain kind of sizes.
Yeah, people are terrible in general.
Yeah, pretty much. Okay, so this story is from our Canadian broadcast company, cbc.ca. It says, today's kids will need right to remove online posts about them. So it says, once they're adults, they should be able to edit their online reputation, a privacy watchdog says. So basically it's saying that we've all grown, this generation of kids have grown up with us, their parents, posting pictures of them online. And what they're saying is that once they hit adulthood, do they have the right to then go back and adjust their online representation? And it says, like, in fact, it's likely that your whole life has been documented in a series of status updates, your first tooth, your first birthday, your first day of kindergarten, your first camping trip. But what now? You're thinking about college, developing crushes, and looking for a summer job. And some of those photos are starting to feel pretty embarrassing. But what can you do? That's a central issue of a new draft report on protecting your online reputation from the Office of the Privacy Commissioner of Canada, which was released on Friday. According to the commissioner, the intent of this preliminary paper is to start a discussion about potential ways to address issues associated with the permanency of personal information online and the effect that it has on reputation. Now we've talked about this before from the parents' point of view and saying that, look, like, you can't just post whatever you want about your kids. So if you're their parent, you should be thinking about that one day these children are going to be older and they're going to be seeing everything you said. So maybe try not to embarrass them. That's the first part.
Right. It says essentially the suggestion is that once kids become adults, they should have the agency to remove content from online that they are uncomfortable with, and young people should have as close to an absolute right as possible to remove information that they posted and that others have posted about them.
Okay, but then, so how far does that stretch? Like, is a child, when they come of age, only allowed to affect their parents' posts? What about their aunts or their uncles or their cousins or their mom's boss? Or their, like, right. You can't, that's the problem with something like this, is good practice is good. And teaching parents how and what they should post about their kids and teaching parents to be respectful of their children as they grow up is important. But setting this precedent where kids can go in, like, how does that work? Like, how far does it stretch?
Yeah, but, you know, right now, if somebody posts a picture of me on Facebook and tags me, I can request the tag to be taken off. I can also request the picture to be taken down. So I have the right as an adult.
So it's not really a new thing. So
no,
kids can do this.
But I don't know if you want to do that to your mom. You don't want to take your mom taking your photo down. And this is where it says in the article, there's a concern that giving individuals carte blanche to clean up their digital footprint could lead essentially to whitewashing history. Some point out that when it comes to harmful posts, youth is no defense for bad behavior. In reference to a series of obscene Facebook posts that resulted in several students having their offers of admission to Harvard University rescinded, Daniel Citron, a professor at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law, said, to not hold students to some level of accountability or to say it's no big deal is wrongful and misses an educational opportunity.
I think what it is it's missing the point for me. Like, the point should be we should have a commission and talk about good practices. Good practices should be taught to kids in school. They should be learning. This is the world they're growing up in and how they behave. And then in terms of parents, that should also be something that parents need to learn about. This should just become part of the conversation. Mm. You know, there's a lot of conversation about limiting time, but not a lot of conversation about best practices of how to share this information with people.
And it's easy for us to do it right now because we don't have to deal with it. My mom didn't have a Facebook account in 1983. Sharing pictures of me or statuses of me too, right?
But we have kids, and I think we've been as careful as possible about what we're posting so that they're not going to lose jobs over it.
Right. I hope something your parents.
Although the picture that's in the article is of a child breastfeeding.
Yeah.
So then, like, that makes me angry because then I have the other side of me that's like, she should be able to post her picture if she wants to. Uh-huh. Like, that's going to embarrass the kid. Like, I don't know if that is, but what do I know?
So, you know, any past historical pictures of me you all take, I have the right to get printed in triplicate.
Yeah, you love old pictures of you.
Mm-hmm. I use them in my talk.
You do. You embrace the embarrassment.
Whatever gets the laughs. You can't shame the shameless, folks. Life advice. Write that down. Until next week. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and visit theunpodcast.com. And remember, friends don't let friends use QR codes.